Good morning, this is Brian Trumbore with your Week in Review for January 17th. Hope you are all staying warm. It's 0 degrees as I record this Saturday morning here in Summit, New Jersey. It was quite a week in New York, and I'm sure you saw it all on television. Michael Daly of the New York Daily News had the following commentary. "Just when we really needed a miracle, we got one. Miracle on the Hudson, Governor Patterson rightly called it. Patterson was standing with the mayor and the police commissioner and the fire commissioner and other faces that had become too familiar to us in moments of tragedy. They must have all been stricken with the same dread when word came that a passenger plane had gone down in the icy Hudson River on a day of killing cold. The dread was shared by all the cops and firefighters and paramedics who raced to the scene, emergency lights garish in the frigid air, and the rest of us could only pray and say, please, not another horror. Only after we learned that all aboard had escaped serious injury did we feel how much we needed this bit of luck when so much seems to be going wrong. Smiles flash beneath helmet brims and uniform cap visors. The most beautiful sight in the city was of the passengers, shaken and chilled, but blessedly alive and unhurt. And most of all, we had the pilot of U.S. Airways Flight 1549. Chesley Sullenberger had remained as calm as if he flew with angels as he made a perfect landing, the nose and wings just right. He remained on board as the passengers evacuated, and he slogged the length of the flooding plane twice to make sure everybody was out. The mayor's obvious relief was joined by unadorned admiration after he spoke to the pilot at the ferry terminal where most of the passengers were taken. This pilot did a wonderful job, the mayor said. We still have the memory of too many horrors. Our economy is still collapsing, and many of us who have jobs are afraid of losing them. But Thursday it seemed as if we had all been lucky, as if we had all been flying with angels. Magnificent, the governor so rightly said." That was Michael Daly of the New York Daily News. I myself was watching the ditching unfold from the television in my office. And when word came out all had survived, I couldn't help but shed a tear or two of joy. Today, all of America has the same thought. Not only is Captain Chesley Sullenberger a hero, but this story couldn't have come at a better time. Even as the wonderment of it all inevitably begins to fade amidst the other issues of the day. Heroes and villains, I mused. We now have a stirring example of the former. While the river in which Sully landed Flight 1549 is surrounded on both sides by a financial sector whose leadership in many cases is worthy of pure contempt. As the captain glided the plane down the Hudson, and office workers pressed up against the windows facing the river, later to learn on their televisions and radios of the miraculous ending, I wonder how many had the same thought as me. Captain Sullenberger was just doing his job, albeit in spectacular fashion. 19,000 hours of flight experience and thousands of hours of training prepared him for this moment. Look at the rescuers, those pressed against the windows were also able to observe. The ferry captains had training too, and reacted in the same fashion as the police, firemen, Coast Guard, and other rescue crews that followed. Everyone not only did what was right, but to a man and woman, they would all say later they were just doing their job. I wonder, again, how many of Wall Street's executives in those glass towers saw the incongruity of it all. None of those folks in the water, from Captain Sullenberger to the rescuers, have the personal wealth of Croesus that they do. But they have the internal satisfaction in that moment of having performed to the best of their ability, and because of it, 155 lives were saved. As for those same Wall Street execs, how many went home Thursday night, looked themselves in the mirror, and thought, have I done my job to the best of my ability? Of course, the simple fact is none of them probably had that thought. They've been in a different world during this era, one not rooted in reality. I live amongst many of them here in New Jersey. They don't have a clue. And yet the rest of us have now been forced to bail them out time and time again since our financial system collapsed. That which they created is now in ruins. Yet not one of these titans of Wall Street has paid a real price or faced a court of law. I like to say, half facetiously most of the time, that the world is 50% good and 50% evil. On Thursday, we had an example of just how much is good in this country, in that selfless call to action as the boats stream to Flight 1549. And now we have one superhero, Captain Chesley Sullenberger III, a moment we can cherish in a time otherwise marked by disgust. On Tuesday, speaking in London, Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke warned that fiscal stimulus alone would not be enough to jumpstart the economy and overcome the crisis. Further capital injections combined with a plan to remove troubled assets from bank balance sheets was required. More capital injections and guarantees may become necessary to ensure stability and the normalization of credit markets, said Bernanke. 2 days later, as the Senate was approving the release of the second $350 billion in TARP funds, and the Democrats were unveiling their $825 billion stimulus program, we learned that Bank of America, which on the heels of the Lehman Brothers debacle last September had acquired Merrill Lynch, was now seeking further massive aid from the government due to losses in the Merrill operation it didn't quite anticipate. Losses in excess of $15 billion for the quarter, as it turned out, while Bank of America recorded its own fourth quarter loss of $2.39 billion. B of A had already received $25 billion in TARP rescue funds, but now it needed $20 billion more to help it deal with a Merrill fiasco, while the government agreed to backstop $118 billion in additional assets. These figures just all run together, don't they? As Bank of America's shares tumbled to their lowest level since at least 1991, shareholders were left wondering just what had changed since the December 5th vote that approved the deal between the two. Why weren't the losses disclosed earlier? B of A CEO Kenneth Lewis claims he didn't know until after the vote. But one thing is certain, more than a few employees at both Merrill and Bank of America didn't come close to doing their job, while the lack of transparency should in some instances later be proved to be nothing but outright fraud. It's sickening that our fiscal and federal deficits are exploding in no small part because of the actions of a few, coupled, I hasten to add, with the irresponsible actions of some of us in living beyond our means. But the prime culprits in the credit crisis, from which all else flows these days, can be counted on two hands, including our president, who hadn't a clue himself what the housing bubble was all about. If Captain Sullenberger is our super action hero, Oppenheimer banking analyst Meredith Whitney continues to wear the cape in her industry. Ms. Whitney said late last year that the recipients of TARP I, like B of A and Citigroup, would continue to go back to the trough for more capital, and that indeed has been the case. And knowing that these firms remain black boxes when it comes to their finances, Whitney notes that it's impossible to know what the banks will earn over the coming year because we haven't a clue what the structure of each will end up being. Look no further than this past week, for example. One thing is for sure, she adds, with each capital infusion, the common shareholders are diluted further and further. Speaking of Citigroup, it reported a fourth quarter net loss of $8.29 billion, its fifth straight quarterly loss, $28 billion in total now, as revenue declined a further 13% from a year ago, with losses ranging from credit derivatives to the value of its private equity holdings. For 2008, Citigroup slashed 52,000 jobs, with another 23,000 to go in 2009. But the bigger news was that Citigroup was splitting into two businesses, with the new Citicorp, including the retail bank, while Citi Holdings will be comprised of the asset management and consumer finance segments, as well as a 49% stake in a new joint venture with Morgan Stanley, to be called Morgan Stanley Smith Barney, and a combined brokerage of over 20,000 representatives. Along with $300 billion in mortgages and risky assets, what some have called a split between good bank and bad bank, or a reversal of the 1998 combination between Sandy Weill's Travelers Group and John Reed's Citicorp. Today's CEO, Vikram Pandit, remains on the hot seat. One bank CEO is attempting to keep his franchise's head above water and his dignity intact is J.P. Morgan Chase's Jamie Dimon. JPM managed to report net income of $707 million, or 7 cents a share, for the quarter, and for the full year 2008, net income of $5.6 billion, But as Mr. Diamond acknowledged, it's going to be increasingly hard to generate positive results going forward. J.P. Morgan faces higher credit card costs associated with the deteriorating economy, for starters. If the economic environment deteriorates further, which is a distinct possibility, it is reasonable to expect additional negative impact on our market-related business, continued higher loan losses, and increases to our credit reserves. Diamond added in an interview with the Financial Times, "The worst of the economic situation is not yet behind us. It looks as if it will continue to deteriorate for most of 2009. More broadly speaking, this week, Alcoa, the nation's largest aluminum maker, said it was blindsided by the pace of the decline in the price of its product, which has fallen more than 50% the past 6 months. Walmart CEO Lee Scott told a retailers' convention that the first half of this year will be extraordinarily challenging. Some people are giving up eating out. Some people are giving up movies. Some people are giving up other things like shopping. Those are fundamental changes that will continue," said Lee Scott. As for the Obama stimulus package, all $825 billion of it, while there are funds for infrastructure programs and renewable energy, a third is for tax cuts over 2 years, with individuals receiving up to $500 and families $1,000, ostensibly through reductions in Social Security payroll withholdings. Republicans quickly noted that there was zero input from them, and it was more borrow and spend our way back to prosperity, in the words of House Republican leader John Boehner. Of course, Republicans bitching about spending these days is more than a bit disingenuous after the past 8 years. I just have to add that personally I favor the outline of a plan put forward by 2006 Nobel laureate Edmund Phillips in the January 19, 2009 issue of Business Week. Edmund Phelps. Phelps argues stimulating household consumption is not the best remedy. Quote, "Weren't we all saying that households are overconsuming?" he asked. Instead, Phelps calls for the federal government to spend heavily on infrastructure, pass an investment tax credit, reduce the corporate income tax, and cut payroll taxes on low-wage jobs. But there's no reason to get too upset over any of the positions just yet. Post-inauguration, let the real debate begin. And so we finally come to the historic moment, Tuesday, as Barack Obama takes the oath of office. I didn't vote for him, yet I've liked just about everything I've seen and heard thus far. I pray he succeeds. The commentator Ben Stein, who was a speechwriter for both Richard Nixon and Gerald Ford, compared his own experiences with what he foresees from the new administration in his New York Times opinion piece. Ben Stein: "The Ford cabinet experience was educational. The men and women in the room, high-ranking White House officials and secretaries of cabinet departments, were pleasant and well-briefed. But they struck me as similar to small-town Rotary Club members or junior Chamber of Commerce officials. Polite and cordial, but far from rocket scientists. They were just high average to B-plus status, with the exception of some super smart types like Henry Kissinger. Going back a few more years, the John F. Kennedy and Lyndon B. Johnson teams were supposed to be the, quote, best and brightest. They undoubtedly contained some brilliant people who led us into disaster in Cuba and Vietnam. Similarly, I think that Mr. Kissinger was and is an astonishing off-the-charts genius. He accomplished basically zero in Vietnam. So let me make it even clearer. The Obama people could be wonderful, smart people in order of magnitude above what I saw at the Ford cabinet meetings. Obviously, many people believe that they are. But they are just human beings, albeit in some cases human beings with glowing resumes. I do not see the supermen and superwomen. They do not have the gift of foresight. They have never been in a situation like this, at least not exactly. There's simply no good reason to believe they will get it right except by trial and error, turning the tumblers until the safe eventually opens. The problems we face now are so large that they humble the average and the above average and even the very much above average. High-level bureaucrats like high-level professors or doctors or investment bankers or baseball pitchers are just people, whether serving with Bush 43 or Barack Obama or anyone else. I can vividly recall leaving those long-ago cabinet meetings and saying to myself as I walked across West Executive Avenue, 'Put not your trust in princes.' It's a proverb for a good reason, then, now, and always." That's Ben Stein. Finally, the economic news continued to be putrid as December retail sales declined a record 2.7%, far more than expected, and December industrial production was off 2%, double estimates, and off 7.8% for the year, as well as the biggest 12-month drop since September 1975. With this as background, coupled with the ongoing carnage in the banking sector, it's easy to see why stocks took it on the chin once again. The Dow Jones lost 3.7% to 8281 after trading briefly below 8,000, while the S&P 500 lost 4.5% and NASDAQ declined 2.7%. Earnings season is now in full force, beginning this coming week, and with the few have reported to date, not one has said anything of a real positive nature. And on that cheery note, have a great week. Back with you next Saturday.